listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. Back from this past week's vacation, there's no newscast at the top of the program, but while I was in Moscow, I did get to do crosstalk, and so we begin with that.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Democratic Party is in big trouble. The party has not come to terms with the outcome of the 2016 election. They have a leadership out of touch with its base. Millennials are fleeing. So, is their slogan now, no party for white men? Crosstalking the trials and tribulations of the left, I'm joined by my guest, Zach Holler in Seattle. He's a writer, activist, and progressive YouTuber. In West Hartford, we have Julio Rivera. He is editorial director for Reactionary Times and a Newsmax columnist. And here in Moscow, we have Don DeBar. He's an anti-war activist and host of a daily radio program. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Zach, let me go to you first in Seattle, because you get up the earliest for this program, and it's much appreciated. I mean, I suppose you came across this walk away movement that has taken a bit of a flash on the internet here. I found that to be very curious because I think instinctively everyone on this panel and a lot of people in the country already know this, and the inclusivity of the Democrats is what they say, but in fact they're actually actively excluding people of all kinds of people, different stripes and attitudes and outlooks. How do you reflect upon that, Zach? Go ahead.
I agree. It's funny because it's great that it's going viral now, but, you know, at least here in America, I saw a lot of this happening in 2016. Yep. The media wasn't reporting. But basically, that's part of what happened in the 2016 election is lots and lots and lots of Democrats who used to be very active voters, active in their community, completely left the party behind for a number of reasons. not a whole lot has changed since 2016, but, you know, at least this viral video campaign is helping more people kind of be brought into the fold since that happened. Because, as you know, I think it's a very good thing that people walk away from the Democratic Party.
Okay, well, I want to go back to why you think it is later in the program. Julio, basically the same thing to you, because, I mean, I've been very, very critical of the identity politics, but it seems to me that since 2000, it didn't work in 2016, and it's not working now, but they've doubled down on it. I mean, that's the definition of stupidity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome, okay? I find it really breathtakingly stupid, to be honest. Go ahead, Julio in West Hartford.
Exactly. It's the definition of insanity, and they're going to continue to do it because they have no platform, quite frankly, to run on. I mean, they can't really criticize the results under Trump because for the traditional Democratic demographics, the Latinos, the Blacks, unemployment has been, you know, at historic lows or near historic lows the entire time. And I think that people that of color and, you know, women and some of those other demographics right now are feel that they're being insulted in a sense. It is intellectually insulting for Democrats to make the assumption that all these groups are supposed to just, you know, coalesce only with the Democrats. You know, it should be about policy. It should be about the color of your skin. It should be about which party will bring the best results for you economically and otherwise.
Julio, and let me go to Don. I thought that's what the Democratic Party used to do, exactly what Julio just said. Go ahead, Don.
Politics is supposed to be the field in which public policy is determined. And in a democratic society, which people refer to the United States as, they've been doing it my whole life, referring to it, then those decisions, policy decisions, are supposed to be made democratically. When you have the determinations of policy made at the beginning of the process by, you know, big money, basically, whether it's Democrats or Republicans who are the politicians that will implement those policies, the job becomes then selling policy that the people don't want to people by Madison Avenue techniques, which is where you get identity politics. We are going to do things that are good for big banks. We're going to do things that are good for the military-industrial complex. We're going to do things that are good for the prison industrial complex. We have to sell it to black folks this way, to Hispanic folks this way, to white working class folks this way, etc. In other words, these divisions, quote unquote, that are, you know, things that are like in a Madison Avenue playbook, are the things that have to be excited because it's determined already what's going to happen. And all they're doing is trying to tamper your response to it. And so at the end of the day, when people don't feel anything actualized through public policy discussions, debates, elections, etc., they become frustrated and they start walking away. And what we're seeing happen with the Democratic Party is the logical conclusion of this process. And I think it's terminal.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, if you look, I mean, with the advent of Barack Obama, what are the fortunes of the Democratic Party in Congress, in the White House, gubernatorial races? I mean, really, it doesn't work. I don't understand why they keep doing it. Zach, let me go to you because I find it, I'm really insulted by politicians that pigeonhole me, okay, you know, because of my appearance. Number one, or some of my preferences, that doesn't determine my political outlook. And they insult the electorate by, for example, if you're a gay person, oh, you must be a Democrat. Really? Why? I've never understood that. Everyone has the right to determine what they think and express what they think in public without being a pigeonholed and intimidated to vote, to go along with the party line. Go ahead, Zach.
Yep, you're exactly right. And, you know, I'm an openly gay guy, and that's exactly what happened through 2016 is people just assume you're voting Democrat. And it's like, at what point in my life did all of a sudden the Democrat, like, deserve my vote? You know, obviously Bill Clinton was the one responsible for two anti-gay federal bills while he was president. You know, find a president that's done more harm to the gay community than the Clintons. You know, so it's like it was always an odd assumption. And when people only allow you to have, you know, I can only be gay and have the view that's supporting this political party, which was described perfectly, the candidates are predetermined by the big money interest. And then they try and put it on the different, you know, voter groups. And it just assumes that every single gay person has the same political opinion. Every single black person has the same political opinion. It's completely insulting. It's completely homophobic, racist to assume that an entire voter group will not do more than vote for the exact same political party. It's absurd. And most people have common sense, and anyone telling a certain person that they have to vote a certain way based on one characteristic of them, that does not compute, and most people will understand.
It's insulting. It's insulting because they take you for granted. I mean, and that's the worst thing a politician can do, take you for granted here. Julian, one of the things that's, you know, really the big buzz with this, the new court appointment, and there is a woman who happens to be a Catholic and has a large family. And it seems to me, when I look at the liberal media, they're more terrified that Trump will appoint a woman. He's not supposed to do that. He's a misogynist, you know. All their fuses start blowing up. I actually find it very amusing to watch. It's like watching adolescents, okay? They betray every single value that they claim to hold. Go ahead, Julio.
Exactly. It's almost like when, you know, the whole foreign policy thing with North Korea started, you know, improving. People were like, you know, upset. It almost seemed like liberals wanted there to be the constant threat of North Korea, because that would have somehow proven that Donald Trump was doing a terrible job from a foreign policy perspective. You know, and just to kind of expand on the whole walk away thing, I think that a lot of people did this a long time ago. I mean, you have to look at the results of elections in 2010 when the Tea Party rose up, when you look at 2014, where there was a big Republican revolution where a lot of House seats were gained and the Senate was retaken by the Republicans, rather, and the 2016 election result. You know, this party has nothing to offer. I can't say that enough. I mean, what's their platform going to be? We're going to increase your taxes, and they think that the common American, the working class American, is going to gravitate towards that. This blue wave that supposedly is coming is non-existent, in my opinion.
You know, Don, you know, one of the things I find really tragic of what's going on in the Democratic Party, because they used to traditionally support the working class people. And I think that was admirable. OK, I do like having an adversarial political system, because you get the best out of it through negotiation and debate and all of that. That's OK. And I actually miss traditional liberals because they actually had a genuine concern for the working class people, for the everyday people, if I can use that term anymore. Why are they? I mean, we see it all through the Clinton campaign, is that don't worry about white men. You know, they're a lost cause. You know, it's not even part of their electoral calculus, which is, in the end of the day, that's what made Donald Trump the president. I mean, how did they miss this, and how do they keep missing it, Don?
I don't know how they keep missing it. Again, the problem is the a priori decisions are, you know, policy decisions are made that way. At the beginning, we're doing this, and it gets done. Now the politicians go out and argue over whether it was a good thing or not, although the mechanism by which this thing happened, there are a very small group of people who were making very big policy decisions that transfer large amounts of wealth into their bank accounts and make the rest of us basically have more problems in our daily lives. So the outcome, you know, among the population is going to be, you know, this is another basis for us being dissatisfied. This is bad for me. I have to work longer hours. I don't have as much money. I'm in foreclosure. I'm being evicted. You know, there are millions of people that are in all kinds of distress in the United States. This has been growing since the 1970s, really, and unabated since the mid-late 80s. And there's no remedy offered in the political system. So when politicians come out and start talking about division, for example, you're talking about an adversarial process. Normally, we're trained to think like in courts. An adversarial process is how you do your, you know, find truth. In this case, there is the adversary is between the people who are making policy and the rest of us, but they have us at each other's throats arguing over what is or isn't true, while all of us are having our wealth transferred to a very small group of people who make those decisions. It's a public relations game, really. It's not a place where policy is made, and that's the problem.
But it's what's really interesting is that we've had a series of revolts. We've had the Tea Party revolt.
Yeah.
We had Occupy, and we're going to go to a short break here. But I want to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when we come back. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue a discussion on the trials and tribulations of the left. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Zach in Seattle. Okay, we've really beaten up on the Democrats, at least the establishment Democrats. Now let's see another angle that's going here. I don't want to give the impression, and I hope we have it, is that people leaving the Democratic Party are pro-Trump. They're not all pro-Trump. Some of them have moved over to the GOP. Actually, a lot of the data says the GOP is still more attractive than Donald Trump. That's the topic of an entirely different program, which I think is quite fascinating, because I'm a conservative and I really have contempt for the GOP. So that would be an interesting topic. But I want to go back to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Zach, I mean, she's a very interesting phenomenon. And she's the most recent eruption of the disruption in the two political parties. And I get the leadership of the Democratic Party just so blinded by all of these things here. They were blindsided by her election. I don't feel sorry for her opponent. I mean, because he's a swamp character. I wish more of them would be thrown out. But, I mean, listening to her on Meet the Press, democratic socialism, I don't think she has a clue what it really is, but it sounds nice, okay? It sounds nice. And considering the empty rhetoric that we have from these establishment politicians, including Republicans, I'm not surprised some people want to listen to that, to be honest with you. Go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, I mean, she's something a little different, but obviously she was supported by some elements of the New York power structure that allowed her to get to the point that she's at. I agree, it's good that she's removing someone who's been probably there a lot longer than he should have been. However, that's not really a great sign that the Democrats have really, you know, revitalized their brand. She's got a very conflicted character in some of the things that she's presented and some of the things that are actually in her past. I think that she's just kind of representation of the Bernie Sanders aftermath. Democrats think that if they use the image of Bernie Sanders, that they can actually maintain some kind of, you know, relationship with Democratic Party voters that are leaving the party. But I don't think that, you know, she's really a good symbol for what's going on, because I don't think that this is a common occurrence. And if you look at who's supporting her from a financial standpoint, you're going to see that it's the same Democratic Party big donor that blew the election in 2016 and have been, you know, turning people away from the party for years and years and years.
That's very interesting. Let me go to Julio. I think one of the things he had to say right after her election is that, you know, ICE has to be dismantled. I was really surprised and really disappointed that it kind of, you know, you have this trickle-down economics, but that was trickle-up ideology. All of a sudden, you have the people in the mainstream Democratic establishment saying we should get rid of ICE. I mean, I'm sure this Alexandria is a nice lady. I don't want to cast aspersions on her. A nice 28-year-old that had a privileged upbringing that showed herself to be, you know, a kid from the Bronx. Okay, good. That's PR. That's, you know, that's how it works. But, you know, I was really amazed how this shock outcome in the 14th district in New York, and it goes into the mainstream, and they want to talk about ICE, no borders. I mean, again, this lunacy is a disease, you know, and Donald Trump is releasing their brain. I guess, because they can't think straight. If you look at poll after poll, Republicans and Democrats in majorities want better immigration policies. Again, they're out to lunch. Go ahead, Julio.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a lot of the quotations, there's a lot of good videos online that show, you know, Hillary Clinton talking about immigration, Bill Clinton talking about immigration, you know, in the past saying that we needed stronger enforcement. And, you know, this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to me, is the worst possible manifestation of identity politics, you know, and she's so out of touch with a lot of the Latino people that she claims to represent. I mean, a lot of those people risked everything, risked their lives, everything they, you know, and left their country to escape those type of democratic socialist policies that they have,
good
like
point.
In South America, for
good
example.
Point.
And her story, to me, is a lie anyway, because her dad was an architect who had a successful business. She didn't grow up in the Bronx. She's not a true child of the ghetto the way she tries to portray herself to be. So to me, she's just a fraud.
Okay. Don, I mean, I think Julio just said it really best, you know, because one of the things is that identity politics per se is not really about those individual victimized groups by white people. No, it's a recipe for power, because this is what they want. They want power. And that's why they can't talk about policy. Okay. And this is one of the huge problems. Like Donald Trump or not, and we've done so many programs on him, he does have policies, some I'm vehemently or against, okay? Some that I agree with. But at least the GOP's got policies you can chew on, okay? The left just have fake pictures on magazine covers. I mean, it's really, really distressing. Go ahead, Don.
Let's look at the last 25 years and follow two tracks quickly and look at this in relation to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. You had, for example, the globalization thing. Jobs were starting to be offshore in the 80s and 90s. Fast forward 1999 in Seattle, I think it was 1999, WTO protests. And a relationship where, the unions and the big marches and protests against, globalization, basically, the unions ended up joining the marches because their constituents went over the heads of the organizers and said, what these guys are talking about are right. It's my job that's getting shipped overseas. Fast forward to 2008, you have the economic collapse. The people felt so insecure. This is America, okay? They elected the black guy. That was a remarkable moment in American history. And what happened? Nothing. Exactly the same thing continued. Policy didn't change an iota. You come up to 2016, and you have in the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, who wasn't supposed to get any lift at all, he was supposed to be a distraction, really wins the primary. Stolen from him. Yep. And Donald Trump, who's not even a Republican, every Republican in that party ran against him, the entire apparatus, both political parties, and he ended up winning that nomination in a cakewalk and the presidency. One last thing on the other track, go back to the 90s, go to L.A. and Rodney King and everything that happened and people going in the streets over that, and come straight up to, Black Lives Matter. And the way that the Democrats relate to that, they try to co-opt it, but in effect, the policies that came out of it, if you look at Bill Clinton with mass incarceration after Rodney King, all the way up to the way people are being treated today in the streets, you have this whole country, huge actual constituencies with real needs that are not being satisfied, and the public relations effort targets them based on these fake, identities that are supposed to correspond to the constituencies, but because they have nothing to do with policies that these constituencies need, they're fake. And this whole thing is kind of collapsing. That's what we're talking about, really.
It's really interesting. Zach, let me go back to you in Seattle. I mean, if we can go back to the case in New York with Miss Alexandria, I mean, one takeaway for me is that both parties, and to a much greater degree with the Democrats, because they can't get that Clinton poison out of their system. I think some people really want it to finally come out here. But I mean, one of the takeaway from that election was we really need a return to local politics to find out what real people are saying, instead of, like what Don says, and I completely agree, instead of having Madison Avenue, do it on a macro all the way down, why don't you start listening to the people, in the local cafe and bakery and find out what they really think, because it seems that they're so very much at odds with the leadership, particularly of the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is more complicated for different reasons, and we can talk about that in another program. Go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it's this kind of weird conundrum that the Democratic Party is in, where they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to have their big, they want to be against campaign finance reform. It really is very fraudulent in many ways what the Democratic Party does. And part of the reason they don't listen is because their exact constituents that they're going after, these kind of identity politics groups, probably for the most part, understand the problems of neoliberalism, and they're not going to be able to get sincere feedback from these people because the Democrats have been the problem for so long that they kind of have to cage who they're talking, whose talking points they're using to support the party as it is now, because most people aren't brutally aware of the failures of the Democratic Party, so they can't even dig too deep. They're not listening, probably because what they're going to find out is information that they don't want to hear, and they've been resistant to taking those opinions into consideration and making action policy achievements that they have to support the reasons they're telling that person to vote for the party. At least Trump's administration has accomplished things. That's why we saw the backlash of the Democratic Party under Obama, is he was barely accomplishing anything. It's like, okay, why should we trust another Democrat when Barack Obama, in my opinion, made things worse, didn't even make progress on a big picture? So it's like hard to trust the Democratic Party when they have nothing to be responsible for having fixed in recent memory.
Julio, the only talking point we've had since the election of 2016 from the left is to hate and undermine and dismiss everything the president of the United States said, the democratic choice of the American people. I mean, it's painful to watch cable TV like MSNBC and CNN. I mean, it's not even worth watching. Like, why should I sacrifice that time that I will never get back in my life just to hear slurs and really just incredible bias? It's such poison for our political dialogue. There is no dialogue, okay? It's just one-way direction propaganda. This is so damaging to the electoral process. And I put it squarely on the left for this. Go ahead, Julio.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, all they've done is be divisive and separate America and you know, just foster all this, you know, this feeling of division within the country. But the one thing that they need to understand is you cannot win a major midterm election. You cannot win a presidency without the most important demographic. And it's the demographic that votes the most in this country, which is white men. They've done everything that they can to sort of, you know, attack white men in this country. And Donald Trump obviously resonated with white men. And the Republican Party is resonating with white men. So, you know, they can go out there and they can pander to every particular race, every particular sexual orientation and religion and all these other things until they start to come up with policies which are attractive to white men. They are not going to win anything.
Before we end the program, I'm really glad that you said that, because it's really interesting is that white women did too, okay? But, oh, we're told by the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, that men told them to vote that way. I mean, they even use the identity politics against themselves. It's really quite extraordinary. Okay, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Seattle, West Hartford, and in Moscow. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules. Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In rapid succession, Donald Trump will attend a meeting of NATO leaders, then meet with Russia's Vladimir Putin. What can we expect from the Donald? And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking Trump goes to Europe. I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Eric Krauss. He's an independent political risk analyst. And in Athens, we cross to Alex Cristoforo. He is the director and writer for TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Eric, let me go to you first here. It's been building up the hype here. We have Donald Trump saying that trade with the Europeans is about as bad as it with the Chinese. That's a very interesting comment. And, of course, NATO is shaking in its boots. It's never had an American president come to one of these annual confabs with disparaging words about its member countries in the alliance. Interesting times to live in, Eric.
Yeah. Trump is making politics interesting again. It's very difficult to predict exactly what he's going to do.
Is that his strategy?
Yeah, it is certainly a strategy to keep people off balance. And he does have a plan. Now, what I think he's going to do is very similar to what he did with Kim. He is going to come in. They're going to cut some sort of a deal, and we don't know what it is. I don't really what the Russians can give Trump would perhaps be a decrease in the role of Iran in Syria. That is within Mr. Putin's gift, and it's something he could probably do.
Does he have any reason to trust Mr. Trump?
No, he doesn't, but he needs to. He wants probably to strengthen Trump's position vis-a-vis the anti-Russian establishment.
Don't you think that would backfire? Let me go to Alex in Athens. You know, Eric, what Eric is bringing up here is really interesting, because if any concession is made, then it's considered appeasement. But if you want to have some kind of diplomatic parlay, you have to compromise. It's a very vicious circle. Alex.
Yeah, it is. And I think that Trump has been boxed in, obviously, by the whole Mueller investigation and everything that's been going on for the past 2 years. But I think he's confident about his trip going to Europe and meeting with Putin. Let's not forget he had a rally in Montana, in Great Falls, Montana, I believe it was. And he was speaking pretty openly about his upcoming trip, whether it was to NATO or whether it was meeting with Putin. He even said that, you know, everything's going to be fine and we may actually get along. So even though he has a lot of stuff domestically that's tying his hands up, he seems like he's handling it pretty well and he's pretty confident about it.
And okay. Alex, he met with Kim, who's the devil incarnate. So, I mean, by comparison, Putin is just a little
demon. One of the interesting things here, Marcus, is that, you know, I think, number one, he thinks this Mueller report's going to result in nothing, okay, because if there was something, it would have been leaked. Number two, it's baked in. Criticism of him meeting Kim, criticism of meeting Putin, it's already baked in. The worst possible things you could have said about Trump vis-a-vis either these two other leaders I mentioned has already been said.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's obvious that the Russiagate witch hunt has resulted in a big, big fat zero. The investigation announced with their biggest single movement forward with the Manafort. They're getting him on obstruction of indictment on obstruction of justice and other charges, tax evasion. They admitted that there is absolutely nothing against Manafort that has anything to do with collusion with Russia or the election. They admitted that openly. So that's going nowhere. But, you know, people who are making noise about Trump here, first of all, Trump has a great deal of animosity with the European leaders. We've talked about this before.
Personally.
They campaigned openly against him. They meddled in U.S. politics. They openly, and many of them openly endorsed Hillary Clinton. The others used their state media relentlessly to attack Trump. This is a little bit of payback. He doesn't like them, and he's making it personal.
And Trump cannot stand May.
May.
There's a real struggle.
Well, I don't think he calls Angela Merkel his best friend either.
So
she's the leader of the free world, remember that? That's what the Obama people
She's lucky she's the leader of Germany at this point, and she's just hanging on by a thread.
Eric, you know, for me, you know, all this hoopla about, you know, Trump and NATO, I think the a more rational, more sober view of this is, first of all, he wants people to pay their fair wage. That's pretty fair. But he's asking them to reimagine the alliance a quarter of the century after the end of the Cold War. And the reason that it existed in the first time, I think if people had an honest discussion about what its role should be, because, you know, what the 5,000 bureaucrats that run NATO, they can't imagine
they
outside of what they do.
They don't have a discussion of its role because it doesn't have a role. It is there to keep the Western world free of a Russian invasion. You might as well spend all this money to keep the Martians from taking Washington.
I completely disagree.
And secondly, there is a very strong economic driver here. And Mr. Trump is a traveling salesman. And the American arms manufacturers are the strongest export industry. And he wants the Germans to spend lots and lots of money to keep Lockheed and McDonald's in business.
Okay, so this is... This is a
this is
the puzzle he wants to put together. If they spend more money, they'll buy American.
That's right. Yeah,
you disagree. Go ahead.
Yeah, I disagree completely that NATO has no purpose. Of course, its purpose has nothing to do with the Cold War and very little to do with Russia. Now, I am a veteran of the U.S. military, including of NATO ops. I've seen firsthand. NATO has never been used in self-defense against a state enemy. So the illusion that it is a defensive collective security alliance is hogwash, right? It's complete absurdity. NATO has, in the post-Cold War era, NATO has become a tool, the preferred tool of U.S. global military hegemony around the
world. Because it's a fig leaf.
It is a political fig leaf. Militarily, it has no real teeth, right? It is a political fig leaf to get the European countries on board behind the U.S., the latest U.S. regime change, invasion.
The interesting thing, go to Alex. I mean, the only real meaningful military player in NATO outside of the United States is Turkey, and things aren't going too well in that direction here. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, if we compare Russian defense spending to American defense spending. American defense spending is to make a lot of people a lot of money. Russian defense spending is to protect the country, okay? And I tend to agree with Eric right here. This is a money-making enterprise, NATO. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the people in the EU, the leaders of the European Union and the governments there have been skating by without having to allocate any of their budget towards the NATO spending and towards NATO defense. I mean, I think you only have 8 countries that fulfill that percentage goal.
One of them is Greece. And why is that?
Which is $350 billion in debt.
But why does Greece spend money on NATO like other countries?
Because of Turkey.
Oh, they're afraid of their NATO ally, Turkey. Okay.
Not only that, but because the deal signed with Germany to bail them out includes strictures that they have to purchase arms from Germany and France.
Okay.
They are obligated by the contracts they have signed for their bailout deals to buy weapons that they do not need from German arms manufacturers.
Eric, do you think that the Trump juggernaut, I think I need to copyright that because I'm using it a lot now, is this a way for NATO to reimagine itself? If it's being given an ultimatum by Donald Trump, the leader of the alliance by far, would that make European members of NATO reassess Russia as a threat?
I think that they have been amazingly successful in keeping the Europeans on side. You'll notice that the sanctions were renewed with no protest from Italy. We don't know what happened behind closed doors.
Well, we don't know what happened behind closed doors. Yeah.
Russia is not the number one issue for any European state. They all have their own problems right now. So thus far, there just has not been the political courage to break. Now, at some point, Trump is going to push his luck a little too far with the Europeans, and they may have to rear up on their hind legs.
Would that be something bad?
It would be an excellent thing, and it's something I have been waiting for personally for the last 20 years. France has become an appendage of the United States. It's an embarrassment. And at some point, yes, we would expect that NATO, the fundamental problem here is it is hard to justify hundreds of billions of dollars of military spending to waste terrorists in the desert, whereas Russia can provide a credible threat. If you want to ignore all the evidence and just look at the military power of Russia, then yes, you need hundreds of billions of dollar weapon and airplane programs. So Russia provides a really useful scarecrow.
Yeah, okay. And we go back to Alex in Greece. What does Putin get out of this meeting with Trump? Because that's, for me, a wild card, okay? I mean, I would say that the Russians have continued to practice, much to the chagrin of a lot of people, strategic patience with the West, particularly of the United States. Now we're going to see it on display. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, I think Putin gets some breathing room. I mean, I think we've just passed 8 years of Obama, and the tension between the U.S. and Russia was ratcheted up to a cold level 12. And so I think by meeting with Trump, he's going to get some breathing rooms. Maybe Trump will give him some concessions on sanctions. Maybe something will be toned down a little bit. Maybe some of the rhetoric. Of course, government-to-government rhetoric. I don't think the media is going to ever let up on Putin or on Russia. But he gets some breathing room, and I think he's already scored a couple of victories. I mean, it's being held in Helsinki. That's close to Russia. It's not being held, closer to the U.S. Trump is coming out to see Putin. So I think he's already scored some victories. And I think it's showing that Putin is a player and that Russia is a player in the world.
I'm going to give Mark the last 40 seconds in this block here. What would a successful summit mean, Mark?
Yeah. Well, one European diplomat observed anonymously to Foreign Policy that a no-news summit would be a win for them, but that they are scared an expletive.
Do you agree or disagree with that?
Putin has already, first of all, Trump has said Russia should be back in the G8 without asking Russia if it wanted to be back in the G8.
It should not.
But they didn't ask. And secondly, he seems to be willing to discuss the situation in Crimea, which is absolutely unprecedented. You have May screaming about isolating Russia. You have Merkel, who's like a deer in the headlights. And then suddenly you have the leader of the free world, Mr. Trump.
It looks to me he might want to be friends with Putin, but he's showing his intense hatred for the rest of
the day.
We're going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's change gears here. I'd like to just highlight an article that I read in consortiumnews.com by Daniel Lazar, the topic title, Corporate Media's About-Face on Ukraine's Neo-Nazis. Now, I know we talked a little bit about this last week, but I thought it was very interesting that his article is a very good review on how Western media pushed this narrative that these are freedom fighters in Ukraine, that there was no coup. And now we have some of the main broadsheets, Foreign Policy, Washington Post,
the Atlantic Council
of all people, backtracking on it. I mean, Eric, what does that mean to you? I mean, why are they doing it now?
They spun a narrative which just doesn't work anymore. That the neo-Nazis in Ukraine have become so egregious and so open that you simply can't hide it anymore. They're not trying to hide it. The Atlantic Council is, for God's sakes, the mouthpiece of NATO.
But Eric, who did the Atlantic Council invite to speak to them? Mark?
Yeah. Andrei Perubi. Andrei Perubi is a neo-Nazi. He is a Banderite neo-Nazi. He was the co-founder of the Social Nationalist Party and another fascist party.
That has an interesting ring to it, doesn't
it? He was also the leader of the self-defense forces of the Maidan, which, of course, went on to seize buildings and kill policemen and fought the new regime into power on the streets of Kiev. He is now the Speaker of the Rada, the number three person in the Ukrainian government. He met with the U.S. Speaker of the House, Congressman. He's already met with the Canadian Parliament, Justin Trudeau, and he is a neo-Nazi. There's no question about it. Here's what the deal is. You know, with these Ukrainian groups, which are funded and armed by the Ukrainian government, they're all even doing children's outreach and indoctrinating children.
And they're integrated into the military
and the parallel police force, right? They've started attacking Roma camps. They've started anti-Semitic attacks, things that can't be covered up. Here's the blunt truth. When these fascists, right, we want to call them ultra-nationalists, you want to call them the extreme right wing, when these Banderite fascist militias that are integral to the Ukrainian regime getting into and keeping power, when they were just killing ethnic Russians, Slovaks, East Ukrainians and communists in East Ukraine, it was all fun and games. That's what they were there for. And no one in the Western media or governments cared. They applauded them on.
Okay,
but
now they're getting out of control. It seems to me that this, in a way, plays into Trump's hands as he goes to NATO and talks to Vladimir Putin, is that if the lid is out off the jar about what's really going on in Ukraine, there's not much reason for Donald Trump to go to bat for Ukraine. After all, he says that, well, the Russians in Crimea like being part of Russia. I mean, is that kind of a way for him to kind of take that off the table, a bone of contention? Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I think it is a bone of contention. And going back to what we were talking previously about NATO and some of the leaders of Europe who Trump does not like, let's not forget that Ukraine was, I think, the biggest donor for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And Poroshenko clearly was behind Hillary Clinton. He was outspoken about it. But going back on Mark's
Chalupa,
point.
Andre Chalupa, looking at you.
Exactly. And going back on Mark's point real quick, let's not forget that 3-4 years ago, the fake news media was calling real neo-Nazis in Ukraine conservatives and moderates. But today in the United States, they call anyone who's for open borders, who's for traditional family values, whatever, they call them a neo-Nazi.
Well,
and it's insanity.
That's a political term that is so misappropriated in the West and overlooked in a country like Ukraine.
I
want to talk about China.
I mean, have any of these fine media actually thanked RT for covering this story first? Because
the Atlantic Council was a backhanded compliment, and this headline doesn't come from RT because we already reported it.
RT, as I remember, has been banging on about this for years.
We have on this program.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, they should thank you.
Okay, I want to thank you for something else. You are an expert in economics and political risk. Donald Trump says you can win a trade war. It's easy.
Yeah.
Now, Russia and, United States and China are going to head-to-head. From what I understand, though, that the exports from China to the United States is only 19% of their total exports. I mean, is this all political? Is this all domestic politics here? Is it the midterms?
You can win a trade war in the same way you can win a nuclear war. It's mutually assured destruction. The economies are simply too integrated. There are too many Chinese components going into American products and the entire global supply chain has been very much integrated. And you have some sorcerer's apprentices here playing with hand grenades. Now, I don't know to what extent they're faking, but if they push it too far, you're going to cause a depression.
Okay, politics is always today and immediate. Mark, yeah. Is this about American domestic politics and Trump's hope to stem a red tide in November?
Even Trump's economic team, as neoliberal and clueless as it is, understands that no one, except possibly for Russia or China, wins out of this. You're not going to recover American jobs in the Rust Belt with a trade war. You'll gain some with steel and lose some with auto manufacturing. Yeah. Right? There's always a blowback. This is all about domestic politics. This is all about showing that he's doing something about the problem of globalized trade to the Rust Belt workers in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin that helped get him elected. The Chinese know that. That's why they've targeted their counter tariff specifically against red state
congressional
goods.
Districts.
They understand this game perfectly. But in the long term, I disagree. Russia and China are going to win this trade war, as are other countries, because what this is going to do is it's going to make other countries increasingly move away from the dollar as a fiat currency. It's going to speed up this whole process.
That is a generational question, unfortunately.
It never happens very soon. Yeah. Alex, let me go back to you in Greece here. I tend to think it's more political. It's a feel-good topic. And remember, this is what Trump said on the campaign. I need to stress this over and over again. I've said he has this envelope in his pocket. On the back of it, he's got all of his campaign promises, and he checks them off as he goes along. He's very fanatical about that. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, as Eric's pointed out, I mean, no one really wins a trade war in the short term. Maybe we can talk about the dollar later. But, I mean, Trump's going through it's a politics of motion. He's doing it again.
Yeah. No one knows how far Trump is going to take this or how far China is going to retaliate. But, you know, it sure makes for a good speech when Trump goes to, you know, those rallies and he fires up the base. So I think, you know, he's definitely we've definitely seen a U.S. president that is going through a list of promises that he made, however controversial they are, however detrimental they may be to the U.S. or to the world. But he's checking them off, or at least he's pretending or saying or acting like he's checking them off. And it's rallying up the base, and it's rallying them up for those 2018 midterms.
You know, Eric, one of the things I've been thinking about, because we're 18 months into Trump's presidency, has he changed the world enough and American politics enough that he's already created a legacy? Because the Democrats and the liberals, they're just hoping you put in one of their guys and we go right back to where we were. This a nightmare of 18 months, then it'll be 4 years, and then they'll go back. And I think they're deceiving themselves, because I think Trump, not himself specifically, and maybe not any one of his specific policies, but he set a new tone and tenor for politics, particularly in the Western world.
Mr. Trump is wonderfully non-hypocritical. At least for once, you do not have the sugarcoating.
Okay, Mark, hang on.
You do not have the sugarcoating of American dominance, which you got with Obama, who could spin the worst policies with his caring and sharing language. Trump comes out saying, we are the biggest dog on the block, and we're going to bite. And he is, he has torn away the veil. And my point is, again, that the Europeans are going to gradually have to come to the understanding that, no, you cannot rely upon the Americans for everything, that we are in France, we are on our own.
And which should be a good thing.
Which should be
it?
An excellent thing. I think the era of American hegemony, which was not necessarily particularly good for Americans, is coming to an end. And this is going to be a very difficult and a very disruptive process. If you look at 1914, the end of the
Austrian and the
Ottoman empires, this was not a gentle...
Okay, well, I want to give Mark the dissenting voice here. Go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, Trump's hypocrisy about just about everything he said on foreign policy. He's attacked Syria. He was adamant time and time again about the U.S. Role in Syria and aiding jihadis, bombing the country, and so on.
It's not hypocritical. He's straight.
He attacked Hillary Clinton for Saudi Arabia, and he's, if anything, crawled even further, at least pushed Hillary over on Mohammed bin Salman's bed so he could make room for himself in there. He's continued democratization and regime change programs. It just came out this week that he is pushing his administration towards overt military regime change in Venezuela.
Okay, we're almost out of time here. Alex, just a kind of thumb in the air here. It looks like the North Koreans are pushing back on the presumption that they're going to do exactly what the Trump administration wants. Is this just part of the parlay? Because I think it is. I think it's part of the parlay where everyone's finding out. The Americans are going to find out that they're dealing with a negotiating partner that knows what it's doing. 1 minute. It's yours, Alex.
A tough negotiating partner. But I think more interestingly, you're going to see the liberal establishment mainstream media jump in joy over
they
the fact
have.
That Trump hasn't been able to seal the deal with North Korea. And it's not turning out so smoothly as he was, proclaiming it to be. And so I think you're going to see the mainstream media actually happy about this outcome, even though I think we have a long, long way
to go. Trump's electorate loves it. Trump's electorate loves it. Nobody trusts the mainstream media.
They're terrified of peace. Okay, 10 seconds there.
Basically, Trump is going to negotiate with Mr. Putin. They're going to come up with some kind of a deal. Trump is going to announce a great new step forward, a new victory for American interests and keeping America safe. And his electorate is going to love it.
He's going to announce the new Trump order. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Athens. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.